I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, fighting wildfires. It's become a big private business. But first, fighting the so-called long war. Today, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is signaling a shift in the American military, outlining a new strategy that says military efforts in fighting terrorism may play a subordinate role to soft power, or, quote, understanding grievances that lie at the heart of insurgencies. The plan is laid out in the new National Defense Strategy paper. Josh White covers the military for the Washington Post. He's read the paper. Josh, remind us, soft power versus combat or hard military power. Joseph Nye of Harvard's Kennedy School wrote about soft power several years ago. What is it?
Well, what Secretary Gates is talking about here is an effort to move away from the idea that we're going to be on a conventional battlefield against a major foe like Russia, for example, during the Cold War, and instead must harness all the other kinds of power that the United States has, economic, diplomatic, and other abilities to go into countries and try to prevent extremism from spreading to a point where it is terrorism like we've seen in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think what he's saying is that instead of using preemptive military might, it would be better for the country to move into areas where we could see extremism rising and try to nip it in the bud.
And you quote from the document saying to do so by promoting local participation in government and economic programs to spur development, as well as trying to understand why people, you know, are angry enough to be in an insurgency. I'm paraphrasing, but you quote from the document that that's exactly what he's talking about.
It represents a shift from Secretary Rumsfeld, who advocated the idea that we should go in and use our military capabilities to deal with these problems. I think what Secretary Gates is talking about is, while that may still be necessary in certain circumstances, that it would be better for the country and international partners to deal with extremism at a more base level before it becomes an issue the military needs to deal with.
Well, you write, the paper also calls for the use of irregular warfare when there is military might, as opposed to focusing on conventional. What does that mean?
He's warning the military not to focus only on the conventional war, and instead to learn from the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan, get ready for roadside bombs and armies that are not recognizable and don't wear uniforms, because he predicts that's the kind of thing that we're going to be dealing with for some time.
And that's not exactly new. I mean, that's something that's been discussed for a while. How does the paper address other countries?
What's interesting, actually, in this particular paper is that Gates singles out a number of countries, such as North Korea and Iran, as countries that we should be worried about. He also talks a bit about China and Russia as countries that we need to partner with and work with to try to prevent them from rising militarily and presenting a challenge to the United States. He also, interestingly, singles out India as a country that we need to work with to try to deal with problems in that region, saying that India's soft power, as we discussed before, is rising and its capabilities are also rising.
What's been some of the response? Start with the military.
There was some pushback and some resistance to the idea of focusing so much on irregular warfare. I talked to a spokesman for Admiral Michael Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, yesterday, and he said the chiefs are comfortable with the final document that was issued. Now, the Joint Chiefs also, every 2 years, put together a national military strategy. It'll be interesting to see what that says when it comes out, if it goes along with what Secretary Gates has identified as the way forward, or if it diverges at all toward more conventional preparation.
And just briefly, I know you talked to some military analysts from different sides of the spectrum. One, a conservative analyst at the Heritage Foundation, says the focus on China and Russia as potential adversaries is refreshing, but says the strategy may be too heavy on battling extremism. Why? What was his concern?
Well, his concern is that if you look at the so-called long war, that he feels like we may be at a point where it isn't going to last terribly long after the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and that it may overstate the case to think that extremist Islamic ideology is going to be a problem for the next 20 to 30 years, and that if you sacrifice everything for that one fight, you may put yourself in a difficult position if other countries rise to power and try to challenge the United States.
Interesting, in that that comes from a conservative. Is that interesting to you?
It is interesting, but I think it also reflects a general feeling in the military and within military analysts that you don't want to focus just on one thing. Gates actually talked about in the document a need to balance risk and to look at where the risks are, whether conventional or irregular, and to focus on the highest risk while trying not to leave too much weakness in another area.
Josh White, military correspondent for The Washington Post. Josh, thanks.
You're welcome, Robin.
Well, some of the people forced to evacuate their homes near Yosemite National Park are returning to their properties, but the wildfire there burned 21 homes over the past week. In fact, wildfires have been burning in California since June. In Montana, a fast-moving fire near the Red Lodge Mountain Ski Resort has scorched nearly 6,000 acres and forced residents there out of their homes. This week, the Los Angeles Times is publishing an eye-opening 5-part series on Western wildfires, saying they're bigger and badder because of drought, rising temperatures, and runaway development, and they're burning faster than ever through taxpayer dollars.
This is the South Lake Tahoe Police Department.
We are enforcing mandatory evacuation in this area at this time.
Oh, my God. You guys gotta leave. I told you to leave. Don't risk your life over it. Just get out of here.
That's some sound from the huge Angora firefight near Lake Tahoe last summer. Then there was last year's Zaca wildfire near Santa Barbara. $140 million was spent fighting that one. Much of the money went to private contractors who brought in expensive planes and helicopters, and crew members who slept in climate-controlled trailers, used a 24-hour laundry, ate at a cafeteria that served up barbecue ribs and veggie fajitas every day for the 2 months that the fire raged. Well, joining us from the LA Times radio studio are reporters Bettina Boxall and Julie Cart. They spent this past year investigating firefighting. Bettina and Julie, welcome.
Good to be with you, Robin. Our pleasure.
And tell us, first of all, you know, we hear a lot of money is spent to fight fires, but can you give us more specifics? You know, what kind of food? Where did firefighters sleep? Why is it something that raised your eyebrows?
Well, we focused on the large fire called the Zaca Fire, which went on for about 4 months before it was totally put out. And at the peak, it employed about 3,000 firefighters. And we looked at one particular day when they had about 2,900 firefighters, 20 helicopters, 8 air tankers, more than 100 engines. And most of the firefighters ate and slept and got their orders in 2 elaborately equipped camps that were set up on either side of the Los Padres National Forest. And these camps are really high-tech trailer villages that are brought in by contractors. I mean, there was something called Camp in a Box that cost about $13,000 a day, and it consisted of 10 air-conditioned office trailers that were equipped with Wi-Fi and internet access and shredders and copy machines. There were shower trailers that cost about $2,100 a day.
You also write about just some of the things that were charged on credit cards at the Sports Authority, $527 worth of anti-blister sticks at the Vons, the food store there on the West Coast, $650 worth of grapes, pears, plums, nectarines. Now, some people might say, well, it's about time, because you talked to a firefighter who talked about the primitive conditions in the 50s, you know, when a toilet was a trench in the ground and you slept on the ground. I mean, many of these firefighters are risking their lives. Don't they deserve, you know, a little bit better care?
Well, I mean, that's certainly arguable. I mean, they do indeed do very arduous, strenuous work. We were just trying to show how you get to $140 million bill on a single fire.
Well, and especially since, as you point out, there seems to be a cottage industry that's sprung up around firefighting, and it's become symbiotic. It would seem that they're just hand in glove.
Well, it has very much sort of taken on its own life. I mean, there very much has sprung up a fire industrial complex, and there are people who supply many of these services who depend upon it. And we talked to a alfalfa farmer in Nevada who sent a private engine crew, a small private engine crew, to the fire, and he makes more money sending these 2 small engine crews around the West than he does off of his alfalfa farming. And he, you know, he just came right out and said, you know, if it wasn't for my fire trucks, I wouldn't be able to farm. So it is propping up parts of the rural West and is an important part of the rural economies in these small isolated places.
Well, and some would say, well, you know, maybe that's good that an alfalfa farmer can exist because he's also fighting fires. But you take all of this further and meet people who question whether even some of the firefighting is necessary. I mean, we know that fires also serve a purpose, clearing out dead trees and rejuvenating areas. And you point out that sometimes some of the firefighting that's done is for political reasons. Tell us about that.
I'm going to hand that over to Julie.
Robin, what we discovered in the year that we took to report this series is not only that aviation has gotten more sophisticated and more relied upon in contemporary firefighting. But there's another element to it, which is pressure on incident commanders to use tankers, big helicopters that we, both in the media and the public, have come to equate with seriously fighting a fire.
In fact, you're right that firefighters have taken to call these, you know, these huge tankers that drop water, CNN drops. Tell the story of, I believe it was Duncan Hunter, who called in a drop like that.
Congressman Duncan Hunter represents an area in Southern California, San Diego area, and he is the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. He's done this at least twice. In 2003, the Cedar Fire, which was the largest fire in California history and quite deadly and destructive, was burning. Very early into the fire, he got on the phone and called the incident commanders and the Forest Service officials on the West Coast and said, are you making use of military C-130s? And the commander said, we don't need the C-130s. We have enough equipment already. And beyond that, not only do we not need them, even if we had them, we couldn't put them up because of the wind. And Representative Hunter, whom we interviewed, said, we'll get on the phone and call Myers. At that time, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Myers, and, you know, the fire commander kept resisting, and Duncan Hunter called and saw to it that the C-130s were brought to California for these fires. And there's another not insignificant issue, which has to do with how hugely expensive they are.
Well, tell us that, by the way. How expensive are air tankers?
It can be as much as $14,000 an hour.
Even if they're sitting on the tarmac and not going up because of weather.
That's right. Aviation is just a wonderful tool when it's used effectively and in the right place in the right manner, but it's very restrictive.
You know, that's the fire drops. But, Bettina, I want to ask you about the actual firefighters, because there's been a shift, as you write, since there's been the birth of an industry, there are more contractors. Are the firefighters that are hired by contractors up to snuff?
Well, there has been a history of problems with private firefighters. I mean, the industry basically began in the late 1980s in the Pacific Northwest and has grown since then. When we were looking at this big fire last summer, the Zacka fire, we found in records that some of the crews had shown up without some of the safety equipment they needed. There was one crew, three members had become drunk at a local bar and come back to camp intoxicated. So there have been improvements, but the problems do persist. And we were told that there as much as 90% of both the equipment and the crews, the engines and the crews, can be private, and that has influenced tactics because the commanders don't feel as confident of the training and the abilities of the firefighters as they would of federal forces.
Well, and a 2005 federal audit found that there was no competitive bidding in these private contracts, adding to the expense. But as you write, the Forest Service defends these private contracts, saying they're sometimes cheaper for equipment, for instance. But now, because of that 2005 audit, competitive bids are now for the first time being sought. That's Bettina Boxall and Julie Cart, LA Time reporters who spent a year investigating firefighting. We'll be back with them. And don't forget, later today, the VP short lists. Back in a minute, here and now. We're talking about Western wildfires as they continue to blaze in California and Montana. With us are Bettina Boxall and Julie Cart, two Los Angeles Times reporters who spent the past year investigating why wildfires have gotten so fierce, frequent, and expensive to fight. And Julie, you went to Australia, where you found that firefighting is done differently. How so?
It's not so much how they fight the fire, but who fights the fires. We picked Australia because it's very analogous to Southern California in terms of topography, some of the vegetation, and the demographic patterns of movement out of the city, moving to the suburbs, and then the exurbs. So what Australian officials have determined after looking at about 100 years of both anecdotal and scientific information regarding fires, fire deaths, as well as structural damage, is that by far, the greatest number of fatalities occur in bushfires when people evacuate at the last minute. So they decided, what do we do about that? And they came up with a policy that protects both the homes and the homeowners. And it has this very clumsy title of leave early or stay and defend. And what they ask people to do is make a decision. If you're not equipped, if you're not prepared, no problem. You're not a hero if you stay, and you're not coward if you leave. Just get out of the area and stay out, and that'll make it safer for you. But if you choose to stay and defend your home, they teach you how to do it. They've determined through their science that homes do not burn in a wall of flames. What happens during fires, and that's very true for the West as well, is embers are born maybe a mile or two ahead of the main fire. The wind drives them, and they produce very small fires. And if you stay at home, you put out the small fires, and when the fire front arrives, you take shelter in your house. It's called shelter in place. And the fire front will burn over very quickly, and sometimes, a matter of minutes. Then you emerge from your home.
Whoa.
90% of the time.
Imagine that's a very frightening thing for people to consider.
It's harrowing. That'll be in Sunday's paper. We follow a family, the Baker family, where three generations stayed and defended their home. And I have to tell you, Carlene Baker, the mother, was telling me this story about a year and a half after the fire, and her hands were still shaking. But when people are prepared, they can make their own decisions. And what the Australian model shows is that when people stay with their homes, both are protected.
Well, I just want to jump in to say before anyone listening decides, okay, next forest fire, I'm staying in my home. You said some key things. They had training and they had sophisticated equipment. But your point is that it must cut down on some of the costs, although, the biggest cost is the cost of a life.
Australia has the largest volunteer firefighting force in the world, and a lot of this policy wasn't developed to save money. You just have to fend for yourself. No one's coming up your driveway with a fire engine.
Well, meanwhile, back to the U.S., where, as you write, the Forest Service spent $296 million just on the aerial firefighting last year, compared with $171 million in 2004. So, $100 million more. And it doesn't feel as if the fires are ending any quicker. And it feels as if there are more fires. Are there?
There aren't more fires in terms of the number of fires. I mean, if you look back and compare the statistics with the 1960s, we had perhaps even more fires. What's happening is that some of them are defying control and burning longer, and the character of the fire, the behavior of the fire has changed, so it's burning hotter and more intensely. So it's really the scale and the nature of the fire, not the number of the fires.
And this goes to a debate primarily out west about firefighting. Why are they hotter? Why are they more ferocious?
For a variety of reasons. You used to, historically, for instance, in the Sierra Nevada, before settlement, you would have well-behaved, creeping fires burn through the woodlands every few years, and that would clean up the dead growth. It would clean up the saplings and basically keep the forest open. So when, the government decided that fire was bad in the early 1900s, that stopped that cycle, that natural cycle. It was basically nature's vacuum cleaner was unplugged. And so in forests like the Sierra Nevada and the pine forests of the Southwest, you have this buildup of fuel. You have in desert areas, in high desert areas, you have invasive grasses that were, again, accidentally introduced by the settlements, the settlers, and they have broken the natural fire cycle, and you've got fire coming through much more often, in a sagebrush area, for instance, where you might have had fire naturally every few decades or maybe every century. Now it's every few years because these invasive grasses. We've been going through a cycle of drought in the West, and that is accentuated the problem. There is some indication that rising temperatures associated with climate change are drying out forests earlier in the season and therefore lengthening the season.
And as you mentioned, there's development. There's just more humans in those woods.
Right. There was one study that found that between 1990 and 2000 in the three West Coast states of Oregon, Washington, and California, 61% of the new housing was in these wildland areas that are fire-prone. And there was a recent Forest Service analysis that indicated that in the years between 2003 and 2007, in Southern California alone, about 190,000 homes were constructed in these fire-prone areas. So this is, putting more homes at risk and also adding more fuel to the landscape. Homes are fuel. There was one scientist who concluded that a square yard of a house has slightly more flammable material in it than the equivalent amount of forest. raising the political stakes, putting more at risk, putting more pressure to, you know, to fight fires, to throw everything at them.
Well, we began talking about the Zacka fire outside of Santa Barbara, California. I just, you know, it's interesting to note that after all is said and done, the aviation, the water drops, the high technology, the thing that stopped that fire, as you write, was fire.
Yes, it was. It was what's called a backfire, and it was actually huge. It was one of the biggest backfires ever set, probably in California. It was tens of thousands of acres that basically eliminated the fuel in front of the fire, and so when the fire got there, it had nothing to burn, and that is ultimately what stopped the Zacka, was fire.
Yeah. That's Los Angeles Times reporter Bettina Boxall. She and Julie Card spent a year investigating the growing cost of fighting wildfires. To link to their series, go to our website, here-now.org. Bettina, Julie, I want to thank you both.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, and still ahead today, the Catholic Church is looking to the military for a few good men. That's after the news, here and now. Both Senators Obama and McCain are on the campaign trail today. McCain at a town hall meeting in Racine, Wisconsin. Obama speaking to supporters in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. But their campaigns are busy vetting possible vice presidents. And the names under consideration say a lot about what each campaign thinks its weaknesses or strengths are. Today we want to go through as many of the choices as we can with Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. And Ken, listeners can see the full roster of your list at our website, here-now.org. And they're going to need a scorecard. Let's start with Obama. You say he's looking for something that might be very different from what McCain is looking for.
Absolutely. What the Obama people are saying is that he's more and more drawn to the Clinton-Gore model. In other words, someone who not necessarily is a choice based on geography or the traditional notion of carrying a big state, but somebody who would reinforce his overall message of change and youth and vigor. So you hear a lot of talk about Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, a first-term governor. He also probably would put Virginia more in play, and that's been a Republican state. He's a Roman Catholic, he speaks Spanish. But the problem with Kaine, of course, is it reinforces the inexperienced notion that Obama has to deal with. So that's one person that appears to be on the short list.
But again, not enough foreign policy expertise.
Right.
And I'm thinking, too, it's a small thing, but you just stumbled and said McCain, and I'm just wondering if they might want to avoid that. What about Sam Nunn, former chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee?
Right. Well, you know, as we go through these, we see the strengths, but also the vulnerabilities. Sam Nunn would bring this vast expertise in national security issues and foreign policy issues, but he's also got some problems in that he would represent sort of the old guard in Washington, which Obama is trying to change. Mm-hmm. And also, he has some problems in the Democratic Party on issues such as abortion rights and gays in the military, where he is more conservative. His name seems to be fading a bit, by the way, in the chatter, and we never know how much to pay attention to the rumor mill. But certainly he's being considered.
Well, all of this is speculation, and we're forging ahead anyway because it's fun to take a look at all these names. Give us some more of yours.
Sure. Well, Evan Bayh, the senator from Indiana, former governor of Indiana, centrist conservative, had supported Hillary Clinton, so it might help Obama in bringing some Hillary Clinton supporters on board. Evan Bayh is a guy who's known as not a flamboyant person, but a very steady person who does not make mistakes and would sort of help even if he put Indiana in play. But again, you get the problem. Does that reinforce Obama's change message?
Right.
That's the calculation.
Well, what about Hillary Clinton? Speculation today that she will be the keynote speaker Tuesday night at the convention, maybe another sign that she won't show up later as VP. But you write that the Obama campaign problem is not with her, but with her husband.
It's not so much with Hillary Clinton, who I think the Obama people have concluded she would be a good soldier and support President Obama if he's elected. It's with President Bill Clinton, who would then be the first time we've had a former president in the White House as the vice presidential spouse.
Well, but he is considering, some say, another woman, Kathleen Sebelius, the governor of Kansas, strong support, ties to Ohio. But as some would say, would that be an insult if there's a woman, but it's not Hillary Clinton?
You know, you hear that a lot. I was talking to some prominent Democratic strategists in the last couple of days who say, yes, A lot of Hillary people say she got 18 million votes in the primary. She's the woman who should be on the ticket, not someone else, even Kathleen Sebelius, who has a lot to offer as a vice presidential candidate.
Well, let's go to the Republican side, where a woman's name tops the list for John McCain, Carly Fiorina, former CEO of Hewlett-Packard. But wasn't she forced out? Isn't that going to be a problem?
She was forced out, and also she got a $42 million severance package, which brings up the whole notion of corporate profits and do business executives do well in the system while working people suffer these days with the economy. Also, there were a lot of problems with Hewlett-Packard when she was there, lots of job losses and outsourcing. So there's a lot of problems with her business background, even though she did rise to the top of business. So she would be a woman on the Republican ticket. That would be a historic choice. But she has a lot of baggage from her business career.
Well, but she has that business career. And is that the one thing that John McCain has to nail with his VP choice, someone who can pick up where he's already said he leaves off on the economy?
Right. He would certainly be very strong on national security. He doesn't need any help there on the ticket, but on the economy and domestic issues, it appears that he does. And that's, I think, why Carly Fiorina is in the mix.
Okay. Give us some of your other names on John McCain's side.
Sure. Well, Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota seems to be rising in the rumor mill now. He's a popular governor in a swing state. He's a conservative. He has, on the negative side, he's not known. We don't know how he'd deal with pressure nationally. His record is a lot of vetoes in Minnesota, which has given him the reputation of sort of Governor No. That might not be what people want to hear these days as far as working with the other side. He has a question about whether raising fees is the same as raising taxes. He says it's not, and that's a problem for conservatives. Former Governor Mitt Romney ran against McCain in the primaries. Actually is a very attractive candidate, has a very impressive business background, but he has a problem on the negative side with being a flip-flopper, which caused him a lot of grief in the primaries, including criticism from John McCain. You hear a lot about former Congressman Rob Portman of Ohio, a very important swing state, former budget director, but he's tied to the Bush economic policies, which are very unpopular. So, again, for every strength, there's a weakness. There's no clear choice here in this whole situation.
Well, what about Governor Bobby Jindal of Louisiana? Very interesting. Born Hindu of Indian parents, he's now converted a Catholic. McCain has a Bangladeshi child. But, you know, he seems to have a sort of sheen to him right now. But might he be too young?
I think that's the problem. Even though he's a rising star in the Republican Party, conservative and appealing in a lot of ways, he also is inexperienced. And so that would sort of undermine the McCain argument that Obama is inexperienced. His name has faded a bit, but in this kind of an environment, a lot of McCain's supporters say, well, you know, he may just wake up tomorrow morning and decide he knows who he wants, and that'll be it.
Well, Ken Walsh, one other name, Tom Ridge, the former governor of Pennsylvania. But as you said, it's just a few weeks out from the conventions, and it seems to be pretty wide open. So do this for us now in the minute that we have. Who is, you know, perhaps a come from behind, nobody's focusing on? One of our colleagues has a wish that, for instance, on the Obama side, it might be Caroline Kennedy, who's on the search committee, much as Dick Cheney was on the search committee for Bush and picked himself. Do you have a sense of someone who's just not being spoken of who could pop up as the VP?
Yeah, well, Caroline Kennedy's name comes up. But I think that at this point, part of what this process involves is vetting publicly. So I think that at this point, I would be surprised if we had somebody who was not mentioned, because part of this process on both sides is to mention them so that if anything's going to come out, it comes out before the choice is made, and they can go with somebody who's safer. So I would say that we probably have a pretty good idea who are on the list right now. And those are the people we've been talking about. In addition, by the way, to on Obama, Senator Joe Biden of Delaware, we ought to mention him, and Chris Dodd of Connecticut, who would offer a lot of experience to the ticket. And both of them, of course, ran in the primaries, but didn't alienate Obama as others, especially Hillary Clinton, did.
Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. We told you you'd need a scorecard to get one. Go to our website here-now.org. We'll have the list for you there. Ken, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And at about 43 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Here and Now. The Catholic Church needs a few good men. The Church has decided to try and recruit priests from the ranks of the military after seeing the number of priests in the U.S. drop 30% since the 1970s. Father John McLaughlin is the priest in charge of the new program. Father John, you've told us you had a brush with death as a college student that led you to become a priest. It happened here on the Boston Common. It's a park. Tell us about that, because you think troops might connect with that.
I was getting ready for a wrestling tournament. 2 days before Christmas, I wrestled at Boston College. We're going to New York City and being a wrestler and cutting weight, and it was Christmas. My mother, Italian, had too much food in the house, so I left to go into Boston and walk around. We went in to see the lights in the Common, and that's when somebody threw a bottle at me, and I turned, and he kind of sucker-punched me, and then somebody came behind me, hit me with a knife, pierced my liver. And laying on the street, I remember vividly that I asked God for two things: to help my family deal with this if I died, and also for God to take me to him. And it was the first time in my life that I really thought about death and about God as seriously as I did.
Did that event when you got mugged maybe give you some insight into how a soldier or a Marine might be thinking?
I thought it could, because they face so many dangers. And I remember a police officer who had been shot and was struggling with forgiveness and things to that nature came up and talked to me and said that he felt that he could talk to me because I've gone through this. And that's my hope. I mean, I haven't been in war or in the military, but my hope is that maybe, you know, what happened to me might be able to help others to relate and to talk to me about it.
Why else would the Catholic Church think of recruiting from military members?
Over 13% of the young men in the seminaries right now studying for priesthood have military experience. And I think probably because, one, the people who go into the military are giving up many things, sacrificing their life, understanding sacrifice and discipline. And so priesthood, you know, hopefully will fall along the same line for them. And the other thing is that they face many dangers, death, see many things that many of us are fortunate not to see. And when you see those things and live through those things, I think it gives you a different perspective of life. I think it changes your views and understanding that, you know, having all the things of life isn't so important, that there has to be a greater meaning of life and something greater than us ourselves, you know?
Well, as you may know, you know, a recruiter can be a tough job when it's a recruiter for the military, because there are questions about the war, you know. And and I'm wondering if a recruiter for the Catholic Church, if you felt that this has also been at times a tough job because of the chapter the Church has just gone through with the sex abuse scandal and questions about the Church. Are you, you know, are you having to answer questions about that from young people?
They seldom ever ask me any of that. They don't care about that. They care about what kind of perspective can I give them about faith and spirituality and what good comes from this bad.
Do you worry that troops going off to war or in war may be a little more receptive to, you know, going into the priesthood than they are when they come home from the war safely?
Well, no, you know, not that it doesn't happen. I mean, when I remember in the seminary that, you know, the story that some gentleman, unfortunately, was having brain surgery and kind of made a promise to God that if he made it through, he'd go into the priesthood. And the Church doesn't want that. They don't want people making promises that later on they feel they can't keep, you
or,
know.
Or when they feel it's going to have a deal on the other end.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know, but what we find most of the people that just finding meaning of life, you know, and even just being away from home for an 18, 19-year-old, you know, it's kind of, it's different. It's kind of scary. Brings a lot of questions, you know.
Well, the military has a recruitment goal. Do you have one?
To get as many as I can. I don't have that kind of pressure, no. The bottom line, Robin, is it's God that is going to put the vocation in the minds of these young people, not me.
That's Father John McLaughlin, the newly appointed National Vocations Director for the Archdiocese of the Military, his mission to recruit priests from the ranks of the active military. Father McLaughlin, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, coming up, Run, the novel that expands family values beyond the immediate family. That's in 1 minute, here and now. The The rapper Ludacris, real name Christopher Bridges, has cast his presidential vote, and his candidate isn't happy about it. Ludacris's new video is titled Politics as Usual. In it, he says he wants Barack Obama in the Oval Office, then adds Senator McCain doesn't belong in any chair unless he's paralyzed, President Bush is mentally handicapped, and so much for Obama patching up that rift with Senator Hillary Clinton.
Better yet, put me in office. Make me your vice president. Hillary hated on you, so that bitch is irrelevant. Now Jesse talking slick and apologizing for what? If you said it, then you meant it. How you want it? Had a gut. And all you other politicians trying to hate on my man. Watch us win majority vote in every state on my man. You can't stop.
That reference to Jesse is to Jesse Jackson. Well, in an email statement, the Obama campaign said the lyrics are outrageously offensive, and while Ludacris is a talented individual, he should be ashamed of the lyrics, which are being played round the clock on conservative media outlets.
Don't belong in any chair unless he's paralyzed. Yeah, I said it because Bush is mentally handicapped. Ball up all of his speeches and just throw them like candy wrap. Because what you talking, I hear nothing even.
Well, out in paperback this week, a novel that also references Jesse Jackson, politics, race, and class divides. Author Ann Patchett sets her novel Run in a Boston where the privileged and the impoverished collide on one snowy night. Her character, Bernard Doyle, is a former mayor of Boston grieving the loss of his sainted wife, Bernadette, his own political ambitions derailed by their biological son, Sullivan's scandalous headlines. Bernard Doyle now pins his hopes for the future on his adopted African-American sons, Tip and Teddy. Yes, they were named after the Boston politicians Tip O'Neill and Ted Kennedy. But Teddy seems destined for the Catholic Church, and Tip only wants to be an ichthyologist to study fish.
Doyle would admit that his youth had been marked by a great interest in marine life, but it came along with an interest in the Red Sox and Latin, 20th century American novels, Schubert and the Democratic Party, and the Catholic Church. His plan had been to pass all of those interests and dozens more along to his boys in equal measure, in hopes of making them well-rounded, well-educated citizens. He did not mean for any of his sons to become ichthyologists. He had meant for them, at least one of them, to be the President of the United States.
And Bernard Doyle's son Tip, the ichthyologist, is almost killed by a car after leaving a Jesse Jackson speech with his dad and brother. He's pushed out of the way by an African-American woman named Tennessee, who was at the same event with her 11-year-old daughter, Kenya. Tennessee is severely injured. And that's just the beginning of Run. We spoke with author Ann Patchett when the book first came out last year. A white Irish Catholic mayor in Boston adopting two black children. Now, right there, you know, that would be a sensation in this city. How'd you come up with that?
I think it would be a sensation in any city, but I think my point was this is a man who wants more children. He and his wife want more children. They can't have any more. And they get to the point where they just want a child. They break through their own barriers until they realize that a child is a child. So there's nothing contrived. They're not looking for African-American children, but they take in the children that come to them.
Well, and it allows you to mingle race, class, adoptions, politics, religion in their story.
Yes.
By the way, we don't want to give away where this story takes us. They all go to the hospital along with this daughter, Kenya. Tennessee and her daughter are very, very aware of these two beautiful young black men who have been adopted by the white mayor. What are you setting up there? Because Kenya grows up in public housing.
The setup really is my historical exhaustion with the term family values. And this idea that family values means you take care of the people who share your DNA. And that adoption is fine. You know, those people can be your family because you pick them and you bring them into your family. I would like to expand the notion of family values to include our community, our country, and the idea of who are we responsible for? Are we responsible for the children we give birth to? Are we responsible for the children we choose to bring into our lives? Or are we responsible for this 11-year-old kid at the hospital at midnight who doesn't have any place to go? Her mother's unconscious. And this family has to make a decision about, well, do we take her home with us or do we leave her for the child welfare services to take care of? That really having good political values means that you are willing to take people in and take responsibility for them.
Because I'm thinking you are a white author, and this is potentially tricky terrain for you to be setting up children who, African-American children, some adopted, some not, some adopted by a white family, because some people will be parsing that to see, what are you saying, you know?
You know, it's so funny. My last book, Bel Canto, was a book that was populated by people of different races. And no one ever says, oh, you know, you're writing about a Japanese businessman. You're writing about a young Peruvian terrorist. There's a certain amount of baggage about writing about African Americans. And people say, oh, you know, do you want to get into that? Is that a good idea? My feeling is, if you're not writing about yourself, you're not writing about yourself.
And to answer if someone's questioning, well, what is she saying? It seems as if, you know, all the young African Americans are loved. It becomes more a story about, you know, class issues, the lives that they are leading.
Yes.
Yeah. What's the role of religion here? Now, there's a statue of Mary, we learn early in the book, that's been passed down for generations on the mayor's wife's side of the family, all the way from Ireland. It also has kind of a, how to say this, questionable lineage, which sort of, you know, the questions of lineage in the kids are raised as the book goes on.
That's right. The statue is not where you think it's from. It is not of the person you think it is of. And the children, it turns out to be quite the same story. There's a parallel in my mind between the role of religion in this book and the role of race, which is so often I find when I read a novel that has something about Catholicism, it's a Catholic novel, it's about Catholicism. If it's a book in which there are white people and black people in it, it is a book about race. And yet I'm a Catholic, I'm a Southerner, I live in Tennessee, and, you know, my whole life is full of black people and white people and Catholics and Protestants. And yet this isn't the issue. This isn't what we're sitting down and talking about. It's normal life. So I want it to be part of the story, but it isn't the story.
Gail Caldwell, reviewing it in The Globe, said, in fact, it's about people waiting in hospital waiting rooms and in the front room of their house and slogging through snow. And there's sort of a pedestrianness to it.
Yes.
Because that's what life is like.
Yes. Yeah. And people will say to me, a few people who have read this book said, you know, they treat those adopted boys just like their own sons. And I said, well, that's because they actually are his own sons.
That's how he sees them.
Sure.
Then there's science. Tip, who wants to be the ichthyologist, and it seems rather than worshiping the church, he worships the fish in these little containers at Harvard that he's studying. What are you saying about science?
Well, I have a big question for myself, which is, if you are smart, privileged, loved, have had all of these advantages, is it enough to follow just your own longing? Is it enough if you could do anything in the world because you had all of the equipment to do anything you wanted? Is it enough to just study fish? Is it enough, frankly, to just write novels, to write fiction? I mean, what is our social responsibility? You know, what do we ever have to give back? I have no idea what the answer to that question is, but I think that that's the question that Tip and his father raise. Tip loves fish. He loves the hard science. And his father is saying, you have to at the very least be a doctor. You have to take this passion and turn it around and help other people. So, you know, I think my whole life I've known I'm smart, I'm good with words, you know, why am I not doing something a little higher? Is it enough to write novels? I hope it is. I don't know.